Busy day for you on Connecticut today. On Thursday, March 26th, the constantly changing coronavirus situation. 102 years ago, another pandemic intersected with baseball. We talked to a sports writer about that in a book he wrote a couple of years ago. How is the coronavirus going to affect the upcoming November election, if it's held in November? We checked in with a nationally known political pundit. We gave you the very latest from Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont, his daily briefing. What about the constitutional issues of these stay-at-home or stay-in-place orders? A prominent constitutional scholar joined us on that. And we checked in with Republican State Senator George Logan from the 17th District to talk about how folks are stepping up from the community in light of the coronavirus outbreak. And we continue for you with our coronavirus coverage on WICC 600 and 95.9 The Fox. A lot of people compare what we're going through now, maybe in some ways, to the Spanish flu occurrence, the Spanish flu epidemic or pandemic of 1918. Fascinating book about that came out a couple of years ago, September 1918, War, Plague, and the World Series. We welcome to Connecticut Today author Skip Desjardins. Skip, how are you? Thanks for stopping by.
I'm good, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming by. What made you write this? What made you focus on this and pique your interest in what happened in 1918?
Well, I'm a lifelong Boston Red Sox fan and have always been fascinated with young Babe Ruth. Not the fat old guy we see sort of running around in newsreels, but 23-year-old in his prime playing for the Red Sox, Babe Ruth. And so I discovered at some point that the 1918 World Series was played in September, which puzzled me. Why would that be, as opposed to October? And also, because of family history, I had known about the Spanish flu, and I, for the life of me, couldn't figure out why anybody would go out to Fenway Park in September of 1918, in the middle of the Spanish flu epidemic, exactly when going and being in a crowd could literally kill you. And so I started to look into it, and as I did, I found this fascinating story about how all the events that were taking place in America and around the world had this odd connection to the city of Boston in that month. And what I eventually discovered was the answers to my two questions. One, the World Series was played in September, not because of the Spanish flu, but because of World War I. The government had issued an order that every able-bodied man in America had to be either in the military or working in a military war-related job, and baseball didn't qualify. And so the government shut the sport down. And the reason people were going out to see the World Series in the middle of this epidemic was that they didn't know there was an epidemic. Just like COVID-19 today, people were infected and contagious for a couple of weeks before symptoms appeared. And so they went out to the ballpark, contributed to this sort of soup of virus germs, and that's what caused the Spanish flu to just skyrocket in Boston a little while later.
Yeah, and it's amazing. You see those old photos of baseball, Skip, in that era where people were really sitting on top of each other and smoking and drinking in the stands. And, yeah, I think your description of it being a toxic soup there is right on. So some parallels that we see, baseball dealing with a virus or an infection back then as we are today. So even though we're 102 years later, there are parallels, I guess, we can draw from this.
Yeah, there are parallels, particularly about Spanish flu and trying to, frankly, avoid having happened to us in America today, that what happened in Boston and then later in Philadelphia 100 plus years ago. You know, the curve that we're all trying to flatten right now was dramatically sharp. It was an actual spike in Boston. The first cases in the city were diagnosed right at the beginning of the month, and by the end of the month, there was a dwindling number of new infections, and the curve was over. So it spiked up rapidly. It was horribly traumatic and closed every hospital in the state of Massachusetts and then fell off the table at the other end really quickly. The problem was, at its peak, it was just devastating. We have under 20,000 cases in the United States total right now. In the city of Boston, in the third week of September 1918, there were 85,000 cases just in Boston.
Wow.
And at its peak, someone was dying in Boston every 9 minutes. Doctors got sick. Nurses got sick. As I said, every hospital was closed, and things were so drastic that they started to use Girl Scouts as nurses because there was no one else left to care for the sick.
How compliant was the population of the area? Because, you know, we have some of these folks today, and you've seen the complaining of, you know, some people won't stay in, they won't socially distance. I guess the people in Boston didn't do that. They did. To what extent did they, or did they not try and do that?
In the early stages, they did not, and it was mostly because they were unaware. There were five giant parades in the city of Boston during that month where, again, like Fenway Park, thousands of people crowded into the street, bumped up against each other, breathed on each other, coughed on each other, and just made things dramatically worse. But one of the reasons that was happening was that they weren't being informed. We forget, but during World War I, briefly in this country, it was illegal to print anything in the press that was critical of the government or what could be considered bad for civilian morale. And newspaper editors around the country actually went to jail. Well, if you're sitting in the newsroom at one of the six daily newspapers in Boston at the time, you look around and say, what could be worse for morale than a giant headline that says thousands of your neighbors are dying?
Wow.
And so the newspapers wouldn't print it. And so for the longest period of time, you only knew that a few people around you may have been sick or had died, but you had no idea how big the problem was across the state.
That's fascinating.
Until it was too late.
Yeah, that's fascinating. A kind of a far cry from what we have today. Skip Disjardin is the guest. September 1918, War Plague and the World Series. Back here on 95.9 The Fox and WICC 600 on Connecticut Today, Skip Disjardin is the guest. The name of the book, September 1918, War Plague and the World Series. And we all know what happened in 1918, the Spanish flu epidemic. However, there was not a smidgen of the media coverage that we have today in the 24-hour news cycle. And as our guest says, that really contributed to a virus that overtook the city of Boston. Skip, you talked in our first segment a little bit about the spike here, and that's fascinating to me that it was basically over and done. You said what, in about a month or 4 to 5 weeks? That was it, huh?
Yeah, you know, it's a little bit like the science experiment that we all did in grade school, where you light a candle and then you tip a jar upside down over it and you watch how quickly the candle goes out. And you learn that that's because it used up all the oxygen inside the jar and ran out of fuel. Well, that's how pandemics end. They run out of fuel. And in Boston, it ran out of fuel within 30 days. Virtually everyone in the state of Massachusetts had been exposed to Spanish flu over the course of 30 days, and there was no one left to infect. And so the pandemic moved on to other cities, as it was mostly transported by troop movement from World War I, sailors going to other ports, soldiers being shipped off to other places or coming, you know, home on leave, or just mingling with the civilian population. But that's how this pandemic will end. You know, in many ways, as somebody spent a whole bunch of time studying Spanish flu, I'm more concerned, sitting here at home in West Hartford, about the math of COVID-19 than I am about the science. Most people who get coronavirus will be uncomfortable and sick for a period of time and then recover. Some will be significantly more ill than that, and unfortunately, a number will die. But the math of how quickly this will spread and how many people will get it, and the knowledge that pandemics always come in waves. So when we get maybe to the end of summer, when social distancing has been pulled back and we feel like we're kind of back to normal, we need to be prepared for the inevitable next wave of this pandemic, which we hope will be not as severe as this one, but it will come. It always does. and that at some point the COVID-19 pandemic will end in America because it ran out of people to infect.
And I guess the thinking here, Skip, too, is that there will be a certain amount of immunity in people if this thing does not mutate that may ease to some extent that second wave.
That's true. Yep. And that's also one of the reasons it is so critical that we get more testing today. There are thousands of people out there in America who have had COVID-19, maybe just had mild symptoms, maybe had no symptoms at all, and have developed some kind of immunity. We just don't know who they are. And the more people we test, the more of those people we will find. We just haven't gotten our act together yet to test enough people. And we certainly are not testing people without symptoms yet. But doing so would be a great benefit to us as we find those people who have some immunity and could work towards finding an immunization or some treatment based on the antibodies that they've developed.
Major League Baseball, the NHL, the NBA, should those activities, in your mind, start or continue in a month, 2 months, 3 months, maybe early fall? What do you think we do with that?
That's a really tough call. And I would like to think that we could bring them back and that people would be disciplined enough to say, hey, look, I'm not feeling well. I've got a cough. I'll stay home. But what we're seeing so far is that people have so little patience already with the social distancing that we're doing, and some defiantly sort of back out in society despite whatever symptoms they may have, that I think even as this first wave of the pandemic wanes, we put ourselves in a tough spot if we just sort of pretend we're all back to normal and everything's over, because people will go to the ballpark and cough on the people next to them. And it will contribute to a second wave.
Unless you sit way up in the upper deck in the corner near nobody, right?
Yeah, exactly. If you stay 6 feet away from everybody all the time, it'll be fine. I'm just not sure as Americans we have the patience and the discipline to act that way.
Name of the book is September 1918, War, Plague, and the World Series. Author and Connecticut resident Skip Desjardins has been the guest. Skip, thank you. We appreciate it. Good luck in the future, and hopefully we will chat later. Thanks, Skip.
Thanks, Paul.
As we continue on Connecticut Today, Paul Pacelli here. Well, we keep you updated on the whole coronavirus situation. And joining us right now is political pundit and commentator over several platforms. You've seen him all over the place. Tom Pacelli joins us. He's got a brand new book, and we'll talk a little politics as this may shake out for the summer conventions and the November election. Tom Pacelli, good to have you back. Welcome back to WICC 600.
Well, it's great to be with you. It's great to be with anybody at this point.
are you hunkered
thank
down?
Thank you for the opportunity.
Are you hunkered down as well?
We are hunkered down. My house has been turned into an elementary school, and we're doing what Americans do. We're listening. We're paying attention to the instructions that we're getting out of the White House and our governor, and we're just we're waiting it out, just like everybody else.
Here's a website, tombisile.com, TOMBISILE.com. And Tom, you've got a relatively new book out. What's the title? What's that about?
Sure, and it's Tom Pacelli, B-A-S-I-L-E, TomPacelli.com. And the new book is called Let It Sink In, The Decade of Obama and Trump. And it is a compilation of my columns from the last decade. You know, if we're going to defend freedom in the 2020s, it starts with understanding what we've really all just been through in the decade of Obama and Trump. There's new commentary and new analysis in there, and it kind of takes us through the journey that we were on and makes the point that the left in this country, the far left in this country, really got a boost in the 2010s. And if we're going to protect American freedom, we have to be prepared. We have to let it sink in that there are a lot of things that happened in the 2010s that cut against our ability to our formula for American greatness. Let's put it that way. And of course, you know, the far left has had the help of the tech industry, Hollywood, the education complex, news media, and even big government conservatives. and secular humanists and others. So it's very important that we understand our history, and that's what this book is. It's a great quarantine read if you're stuck in the house. It's an easy read, and it helps prepare us for when we come out of this to ensure that we're going to be stronger and we're going to be able to defend American values.
Well, Tom, there is a political process still going on at all levels in this country, especially nationally. And now that we think there's a stimulus bill coming out of Congress, and we think now that states are battening down to battle this coronavirus thing, a lot of folks now are turning their eyes toward the rest of the year, the conventions, how those may play out, what the election may play out if it's done on time this November, and the current response to what's going on in the White House. And just want to know what your take is on that, in as much as we've had a couple, three polls over the past week that, you know, at least numbers wise on the surface are boding pretty well for President Trump, despite a rocky start to this coronavirus response.
Yeah, you know, Paul, one of the things that's important for everybody to remember about this is that there is nobody, literally nobody alive in this country who has been through this type of pandemic, this type of domestic national emergency. And so it's important for people to realize, yeah, the government is, and not just the federal government, but our state governments, our local governments, they are all finding their way through this. And I know that there is a tendency in today's media culture and our social digital culture for people to want the government to snap their fingers and everything be fixed, but that's not realistic. I do think that after, as you pointed out, a rocky start, the administration and the president in particular has really stepped up to the plate. They've done things that no administration had ever done before. And they're getting bipartisan praise across the country for being engaged, being responsive. Secondly, the other thing that I want to point out is that, and this is really critical for people to remember, our system of government is based on federalism. Now, in our pandemic planning that we have done in this country for many years, is based on that system. What does that mean? That means that our governors are running point on the execution of the public health systems in our states with the support of the federal government. We spend a lot of time, you know, blaming Trump, blaming Washington, but the fact of the matter is that the president's role here is to support what the governors need. And I think that when you look at the response that even governors like Cuomo and Newsom have said, that the White House is doing what it needs to do to ensure that we are ramping up production of ventilators, that we are helping support their process locally.
As we continue on 95.9 The Fox and WICC 600, another day of Connecticut Today for you. Tom Basile is the guest. We've had him on before. Great stuff from a nationally known commentator, author, political pundit. Tom, when you look at what's happening with the White House and the daily briefings and stuff that the president's throwing out there, he's getting a lot of flack from some people for alluding to possibly reopening or jump-starting, whatever that means, America again, maybe as soon as Easter Sunday. Tom, you know, and this is just my thought on it. I don't know whether you agree or not. To me, when the president did that, I think he just threw out some point of light at the end of a tunnel. And I thought, Tom, more than anything else, it was an effort to kind of calm the markets down a little bit and say, we've got this, we have a timeline. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I agree with you, Paul. I think the president is being aspirational. I think personally he's getting maybe a little too far out in front of his skis. I think that's a very, very optimistic timeline. But I think that the president is trying to give people some hope and trying to prepare the country for, hey, look, we're not going to do this for 6 months. You're not going to be locked in your house for 6 months. And they're talking about some sort of a rolling response where you're moving from the hot spots. You're analyzing how the virus is moving and or where the virus is. and you're trying to evaluate where places can open. Certainly, he's also trying to give people hope with respect to these drug protocols, which are now being tried in New York and other places to try and treat it. But ultimately, you can't have this economy on lockdown for months at a time. That's going to be very dangerous for the vitality of the country overall and our ability to come back. So I think he's trying to strike a balance. Certainly, the left-wing news media is mortified at the fact that his handling of the responses in the 60s is being polled positively in the 60s, and that he's at historic highs in terms of his approval rating. But people respond when their president is active and looking like he is trying to do everything he can.
Yeah.
To protect workers and protect public health, people are going to respond positively to that.
And we're still going to have, I think, some sort of a campaign. Tom Baselli, what do you think? The conventions, will they happen? You know, Joe Biden, God bless him, because of his age, he is a very senior citizen. He's staying inside. He's isolating, trying to do stuff online and on TV, you know, play the interview circuit from his living room. But, man, this could make for a very bizarre campaign coming up.
It could, if it lasts long enough. The conventions could be postponed, but you know, for the Biden campaign, remember there's a big enthusiasm deficit here between Republicans and Democrats by as much as 10%. And as much as the media tries to say to everybody that everybody can't stand Trump, Biden is not a candidate that before all of this was really lighting the world on fire. He was not generating the type of passion that you need to oust an incumbent president. And since he has been cloistered in his darkened living room doing these interviews, he hasn't distinguished himself at all. He had an interview on ABC where he was barely coherent. He did another interview on MSNBC in which he lost his thought process in the middle of his sentences more than one time. The host didn't even know really what to do with the interview. You're seeing he's being also overshadowed by governors like Andrew Cuomo or Gavin Newsom and other players within the Democratic Party who are engaged in this fight. They are relevant to this response, and they are raising their profile and actively engaged. And he's sort of watching from the sidelines, trying to be relevant. That's a real problem for the Biden campaign over the next couple of months.
Finally, Tom Baselli, what do you think of this kind of bubbling undercurrent now of, you know, draft Newsom, draft Cuomo? I have friends of mine who are all, you know, agog about Andrew Cuomo. And I said, well, fine, you plug him into a Midwestern voter's head with his, you know, his policies on guns and illegals and cash-free bail. I don't think that's going to play in the Rust Belt if they tried it.
Yeah, I think it underscores the fact that people really don't think Biden has what it takes to win this election. And that's always been a concern right from the very beginning. And he is sort of the last man standing in this nominating process. So it underscores just how, again, that enthusiasm deficit. The president's supporters are very enthusiastic. He still maintains 90% support thereabouts among Republicans. His numbers are improving among independents. But I tend to agree with you. Anybody who thinks that Andrew Cuomo is great because he's doing these press conferences, they should try living in New York and paying our taxes. But it just underscores the serious problems that the Democrats are going to face going into November. Should the president continue to show very strong leadership.
The name of the new book, Let It Sink In, The Decade of Obama and Trump. The website, Tom Baselli, BASILE.com, TomBaselli.com.
Thank you very much, and you can get the book on Amazon.com. I know nobody's going out to bookstores. Just go to Amazon.com, and you can grab Let It Sink In, The Decade of Obama and Trump.
Tom Baselli, thanks so much, Tom. We appreciate it, and go back to the brood there. Keep everything calm in the household, okay?
Thank you very much, Paul. God bless.
We now take you live to hospital for today, to a Hartford, rather, for today's briefing with Governor Ned Lamont. Let's join that live in progress.
It's going to make a big difference for a lot of folks here in Connecticut and across the country. But for starters, just wanted to give you my daily update on what's going on here in Connecticut before kicking it over to them. And the information is sort of interesting. The number of folks infected actually went down a little bit, and testing went down a little bit. And the percentage of people who are infected went down a little bit. I don't think you can make very much from a one-day sample, by the way, but it is indicative of how these numbers are going to bounce around a bit, and I don't want you to jump to any conclusions too early. We have about 125 hospitalizations, 21 fatalities now, 19 of those people who sadly died are over the age of 70, and 15 of them are over the age of 80. That tells you a little bit about the demographic risk we have. I'd like to say something broadly also, because I've heard from a number of the folks running our hospitals that the testing will not be going up for the near term and may slow up just a little bit, and our centers can talk about that. In part, what they're saying is, given the shortage of PPE, the protective equipment, and the masks, we need those nurses in the hospitals taking care of the critical care patients. And we can only have so many of them doing the testing necessary for you. So we're going to test those that are most critically in need. We're going to test those frontline responders we have to make sure are safe so they can be there to continue to take care of you. And again, those with the most severe conditions, with a doctor's permission, we're still going to be able to do that. So in the meantime, I'm going to put much more of an emphasis upon a self-diagnosis and really urging each and every one of you to take your fever, see if you have any flu-like symptoms at all. If you have any symptoms at all, assume it's COVID-19 and go home. And stay there for 14 days. If it's light flu or something else, it's really the same therapy. Go home, self-quarantine, and 99% get better, and those few that don't, call your doctor and we'll have you tested. I say that in terms of what I think about the workplace, because I've had a lot of questions about essential workers and the such. Let's say our factories. Our factories are open, and Sikorsky and Pratt. I'm really proud that increasingly they're trying to do a fever test for anybody that may be going into the factory floor where there could be hundreds, if not thousands, of people. And not just our major factories, but also a lot of the smaller factories that are part of the supply chain there. It is so important that you self-diagnose. And if there's any risk, any thought that you may have a flu-like symptom, go home and stay home. And I'd say more broadly, for anybody over the age of 60, go home and stay home. For folks over 60, here's my strong advice to you. Stay home. I urge you, don't go out. Don't go out for shopping or anything else unless you have to. If you have a trusted neighbor, you have a family member, have them go use one of our pickup restaurants, deliver some food to you, but stay home. And if you don't have that trusted neighbor or family friend who's there to, provide that, we're working with Stop and Shop and a lot of our other amazing grocery stores to have them open at an earlier hour, like 7 to 8 in the morning, just for you, so that you can be there more safely. And that's incredibly important. We're getting the spaces lined up at these grocery stores so you're no more than 5 or 6 feet apart as you're waiting in the cashier's line. The social distancing is more important than ever, just as we see the crush of infections and people moving into our hospital beds coming up from the south, further north. I'd like to say one other thing in terms of social gathering. You know, before we had said 50, but use your common sense. I'm going to be stricter than that. No more than 5 people in a social gathering, and less than that if you possibly can. When you're taking a walk outside, when you're seeing friends, stay apart and no more than 5. This is really important because even though young people are much less likely to have a severe condition from COVID, you're just as likely to pass it along either at home or to, older folks. So I really want to be strict on that, no more than 5 people. Our store limits and the such are still going to be no more than 50 in those bigger stores. Everybody else, I'm really proud to see at our grocery stores, for example, people are waiting outside, separated by 6 feet, waiting to go in as necessary. Talking about self-diagnosis and self-quarantining, there's been a lot of questions about people who come in from out of state. And as said yesterday, a lot of our social distancing is already working. Ridership on Metro North is down 95%. You've seen the, roads are almost empty in many cases. But I want to be really strict on this. If you don't have to travel to the state of Connecticut, say you're from New York City, a place that is a hot zone, it's better to stay home. It's better for you and better for the broader community. If you do think about coming to a state like this, I want you to A, self-diagnose in a serious way, and B, self-quarantine. Make sure you are 100% healthy after 14 days before you do a lot of circulation up here. It's a one way that both New York and Connecticut and our neighboring states working together can hold down the spread of this virus. In terms of social gatherings, we just got off the phone with the president and vice president, and, again, he was talking about getting us back to business as usual sooner rather than later, which if you're a state right next to New York City, which is the epicenter of the COVID crisis, I think is bad, bad advice. He says, jam the aisles at the pews and Easter. I'm really proud of here in Hartford, where the Archbishop said, sadly, we're not going to be able to have church services on Easter. And I think you're seeing good common sense across the state when it comes to our churches and other gatherings like that. God helps those that helps themselves. And Connecticut is standing up and doing the right thing. It breaks my heart because everything I'm recommending is contrary to everything that I've always told my kids and I've tried to live by. Don't go visit Grandpa. Go teach him to FaceTime or drop food off at his front step. Don't go to work. Don't go to church. Skip church. But everything is different these days, except for the old axiom, you can't be too safe, or it's better safe than sorry. And I'm going to follow that maxim until we get through this crisis and we get through this crisis together. Look, I just want to say I'm incredibly proud to be here with Senators Blumenthal and Murphy. They were up all night last night. I'll tell you, it's a much better bill that came out of the Senate and a much better bill that we're going to have for the state of Connecticut thanks to their good work. I really appreciate the $150 billion that is going to all the governors spread across so we can target that money where it's absolutely necessary. I really appreciate what you're doing on unemployment compensation because there we have a desperate need right now. But I'll tell you, we still have some work to do. I was talking to Commissioner Westby, and he said, we are a couple of weeks behind in processing all those unemployment claims. The number of claims that's come in is well over 100,000, and we are just scrambling to catch up. We have an old COBOL platform computer system, dates back 40 years, and so unfortunately it was scheduled to be fixed in 9 months, but that's not quite good enough. And don't think, guys, that we can link over to the system at a Department of Labor in Washington, D.C., because that crashed as well. But more importantly, I appreciate what you're doing, and I, as governor, each of us here in this building, the Capitol, are going to make sure that we can execute on the incredible good things you're doing for us and make sure they work for the people of Connecticut. So with that, I'd like to ask Dick Blumenthal, sure, my friend, to say a few things.
Thank you. I'm proud to be here. Proud to be with Ned Lamont, who has been a national leader, really at the forefront of states filling the gap that the federal government has left and the president has failed to fill. I agree with the governor that the president's expectation that we're going to be back to normal by Easter is not only bad advice, it's worse than bad. It is abysmal because the disease is going to set the timetable here, and we cannot have economic recovery unless we heal the public health emergency. the two must be accomplished together, and to belittle the health emergency is irresponsible and, in fact, unconscionable. Ned Lamont's leadership has been in dramatic contrast to what we've seen in the White House. What we've seen there is too little, too late. Testing was too little, still too late. Provision of equipment, like personal protective equipment, still lacking, chillingly so, in many of our health centers. I've talked to health centers, advocates for domestic violence shelters, homeless housing, all kinds of nonprofits across the state, as well as small businesses. And what they have said to me is they need leadership in Washington, D.C., and it has been lacking and laggard all too often, in contrast to what we've seen from Governor Lamont. So I'm really pleased to be here today, and I think especially lacking at this particular moment, and Senator Murphy's been a leader. I've worked with him in calling for the president to use the Defense Production Act so we can produce some of that equipment. The biggest corporations and our labor unions are pleading with the president to produce more of this equipment by using the Defense Production Act, and repeatedly we've called on him to do it, but so far he has failed. This bill is a massive down payment, by far the biggest such relief package in the nation's history, $2 trillion, the size of the federal budget, and it was made better because we took it from McConnell and made it truly bipartisan, not just better, but bigger. And it provides for a medical surge, a Marshall Plan, that will help provide that equipment, the supplies, the masks, gowns, tests, the personal protective equipment that is needed in Connecticut and around the country, and that will help to fund the vaccines and treatment that the nation needs. And that Marshall Plan recognizes that we do have to address the healthcare emergency in order to successfully confront the economic crisis. But the basic goal here is to put as much money as possible, as quickly as possible, into the hands of workers, families, and small businesses. Very simple. And this bill accomplishes it through a one-time payment of $1,200. You're familiar with the details. I'm not going to go into them. But essentially, this money will go to them within the next 3 weeks, and it will be theirs to spend as they wish to cover the costs of their mortgages and rent and groceries, basic human needs. But we've also heard from small businesses who are struggling to survive. And loans going to them, $350 billion or more, can be used for rent, utilities, but also can be forgiven if they continue to employ their workforce, a powerful incentive to keep people at work. And if they're laid off, we have a vastly expanded unemployment insurance program, increasing by $600 the amount that goes to every person who is laid off or furloughed. Very important addition. People who are furloughed are eligible, and it is for 4 weeks, a tremendously significant extension. So the objective here is to put cash into the hands of those workers, of small businesses that are the backbone of our economy and who are struggling to keep their doors open and keep their folks on the payroll. And I have heard from them urgently, we all have, and we are heeding their pleas.
All right, we got a couple of calls waiting. First, though, let's head back up north to Hartford. We'll check out continuing comments of Governor Ned Lamont and Connecticut Senators Richard Blumenthal and Chris Murphy.
I'm hoping that those stages and steps in the future, the new relief packages, fourth, fifth, maybe sixth, will be bipartisan. The first three were. And the unanimous vote last night, I hope, signals that our Republican colleagues sense the magnitude of this moment and the crisis that our nation faces. So with that, let me turn
Let me just say one thing. Thank you, Senator Blumenthal. You mentioned small business, and you mentioned this bill is better for the work that you and Chris put in. I had an opportunity to talk to Senator Murphy a lot about this. And early on, when it came for support for small business, they were talking about a payroll tax holiday or an income tax credit, which every small businessman knew was absolutely meaningless when your revenue has disappeared and there is no income. And one person who understood that really well was Senator Murphy, and he made sure the small business support stood up $350 billion, a forgivable loan if you keep people in place so that we have an economy that's ready to start up again. We're on the backside of this crisis.
One more point, if I may, Governor. The governor, as you know, has issued a disaster declaration, and Senator Murphy and I have written, the whole delegation has written in support of it today. So we've been united as a delegation. We've picked parts of this package that were important to us, as we usually do, working on different aspects of it, and I'm happy to yield to my colleague.
Great. Thank you very much, Dick. Ned, thank you for allowing us to join you here today. Let me first thank the people of Connecticut. These are extraordinary times, and all across this state, ordinary citizens are stepping up and doing the right thing for their neighbor, offering to go pick up groceries so an elderly neighbor doesn't have to do it for themselves, offering to do a chore that someone who is quarantined cannot. And of course, making daily decisions to engage in self-distancing and following the governor's recommendations to stay home and to stay safe, and to limit your interactions to small groups of no more than five. This is a unique threat to the nation. It is a threat that government cannot defeat alone. It can only be met, it can only be conquered, if ordinary average citizens decide to step up and do the right thing day after day after day. Governor Lamont has been ahead of the curve from the very beginning. Senator Blumenthal is right. He has been a leader in Connecticut, but he has also been a national leader. He has modeled responses that other states are following, and we are very lucky to have him. As he mentioned, he and I think, talk every day, making sure that he knows what's coming from the federal government, but also to make sure that we are molding federal policy to meet what Connecticut needs. And I think that this package that we passed last night in the Senate will be effective in staving off catastrophe, but it is not the end of our work. I don't want to go over everything that Senator Blumenthal did already, but let me note that the Treasury is hoping to send out these cash payments to families within the next 3 weeks. This will be a important infusion of money, not just into individual families, but also into the economy writ large. Those unemployment benefits are not only extended for four additional months, recognizing that people are going to be unemployed for a longer period of time now than in previous recessions, but they are increased by $600 per week. That's a significant increase. The average unemployment benefit check in this country is somewhere just short of $400.
We continue our coverage regarding the coronavirus situation. A lot of people with questions, you know, regarding laws now and all these different recommendations. Do I have to do this? Do I have to do that? Are my constitutional rights being violated in any way? We saw some people worrying about gun stores being closed. Is a gun store, you know, a needed place, an essential place to be open? one of the folks that we go to, we've had him on the show a couple of times, when it comes to constitutional powers in times of national emergency, Professor Rob Nadelson, an expert on constitutional law. He heads the Constitutional Studies Center. He's also a contributor to the Epoch Times, and we welcome Professor Nadelson back here to WICC. Professor, how are you today?
I'm great, and it is a real kick to be back with you. I'll say that.
Well, thank you, Professor. I appreciate that. Now, Professor, before you called in, let me give you an example. Our governor, Ned Lamont, who I think has done a good job in this coronavirus thing, he got up there and he does his daily press conference, his daily news conference, and he gives, you know, kind of the bad news, the number of cases, the people that have succumbed to this disease. But he also said today, listen, I'm asking the number of people who are gathering to go down from 10 now down to 5. We hear that from other governors. Our governor here has said, but we're not going to really enforce that on the state level. That's a local police level. And, Professor, you should probably know, you're probably getting these questions. A lot of people are kind of confused about this. And the initial question I get is always, is that legal? Talk a little about this and all these declarations in the times that we're facing.
Sure. The states have a broad series of power that the courts call the police power. And when I use the word police, I'm not referring to the local cop on the beat. I'm referring to an older use to mean the governance power. The federal government actually doesn't have this police power outside the District of Columbia and a few other places. It's the states that have it. And it is broad enough to include response to disasters, emergencies, epidemics, and so forth. And there's a long history of government doing so. However, the government's police power is limited by the state constitution. It's limited by the U.S. Constitution. And whatever the governor does has to be as a result of powers he gets, either from the state constitution or from state statute. So I look at something like reducing the number of people collecting together from 10 to 5, and I say that's probably okay. On the other hand, some of the mass lockdown orders we've seen, which are far broader than necessary to deal with the crisis, they really are running up against constitutional rights such as the right to travel or the right to assembly.
So when governors and local leaders say this stuff, Professor, obviously they know this. I mean, most of them are in high office. Many of them have law degrees. So they're just trying to phrase it as nicely as they can and hoping that reason wins out here, correct?
Well, I mean, governors have a whole lot of different motives, and some of them are more sensitive to limits on their responsibility than others. Some of these statutes which grant them emergency powers are a little vague. And just because somebody's a lawyer doesn't mean he's a constitutional scholar, right? And so, and there's also, as you know, a large climate of fear and hysteria now. The fact that we hear about these deaths tends to cloak the fact that all the coronavirus deaths that have happened in America since the beginning do not equal the number of deaths that occur in this country as a result of cancer in a single day. And so that kind of puts it under perspective. It's a serious crisis, no question about it. But on the other hand, I think it's not a good service to encourage panic.
Constitutional law professor and scholar Rob Nadelson is the guest. It's Professor Rob Nadelson, recognized constitutional expert, law professor for 25 years. Professor Nadelson, is it legal to close gun stores during a time of crisis like this?
That is really a good question. And the answer is, it depends. If there is an order which applies to all retail establishments and tells them to close down, and the gun stores are part of that, I think that's generally okay. If, on the other hand, it can be demonstrated that they're targeting gun stores, then that's not okay. And by the way, the same thing has to do with churches, because churches are protected by the First Amendment. If the government says we don't want anyone assembling in groups of more than 10, and that applies to churches as well as everybody else, then that's okay. But if there's a deliberate intent to go after churches and synagogues or mosques. That's not okay. So it largely depends upon the government intent.
Do you think, Professor Nadelson, that the founders, who were very bright men with very bright women behind them, do you think that when they wrote the Constitution, obviously they had knowledge of, these were very learned men, they knew of plagues, they knew of medical emergencies throughout early history, they had obviously read about that. Did they make any sort of reference to this? And obviously not the Constitution, but in the Federalist Papers and anything that maybe, Jefferson or Madison or people like that ever wrote or not?
Paul, they knew of epidemics that made this coronavirus situation look like a sniffle. Yeah. I mean, they knew of the Black Death, which killed from a third to half of people in Europe. They were very knowledgeable about that. They did not adopt the federal government to deal with epidemics. The federal government certainly has a role. For example, the federal government should close down traffic from any country where there's an epidemic going on. But they recognized that the primary response to epidemics, like other health issues, was supposed to be at the state level. The great John Marshall, most important Chief Justice mm-hmm. we've ever had, who was also an important founder in that he promoted adoption of the Constitution in Virginia, made a comment in one of his cases. In fact, it's a part of the case that usually is not included in law school, that that health laws of every description are reserved to the states. That's why they have the police power. The idea that the federal government is going to get us another $2 trillion in debt to deal with coronavirus would not be something of which they approved. Not because they didn't believe in a response, the founders would have said, that's why we have state governments, that's why we fund them. They have the expertise to respond to local conditions.
So, Professor, going forward here, the president obviously is trying to put a little light at the end of the tunnel here, maybe to calm the markets, to stop these wild swings, preserve people's retirement funds, what may be left of them. It sounds like, from what I heard today, with targeting certain areas of the country and certain counties and ranking them and this and the other, are we looking at kind of a combination effort here of the federal government providing sources, but working within a framework of federalism? Do you think that's what we're looking at here in the next few weeks?
Well, I don't really know if they're working within I guess to a certain extent they're working within the framework of federalism. They're probably not relying upon state governments as much as they should. I'm also concerned, though, with some of the responses at the state level as well. I mean, general shutdown orders, stay-at-home orders, that was tried in Italy. They were the first ones to do it, and it hasn't worked as far as I can tell. I check the website of the Ministry of Health of Italy daily, and the number of coronavirus cases in that country continues to soar, where in other countries, like, for example, Taiwan, they did a very different approach, and that approach has worked spectacularly. So I'm not sure that the way we're attacking this at either the federal or the state level is wholly satisfactory. But from a constitutional standpoint, it's better that it be done at the state level than at the federal level.
Finally, Professor Nadelson, is there one particular thing, and we may have already touched on it, but is there one particular thing in all this that we've been through and we will likely go through for another month or two? Is there one thing that's really bothering you that really gives you a little bit of nausea when you see what's going on? What would that be?
What would give me some nausea would be the way people are panicking and saying, that the government should do things without regard to individual rights, without regard to the economy, without regard to the Constitution. It seems like every generation has to learn this over again. I mean, during World War II, for example, we incarcerated in concentration camps about 120,000 American citizens of Japanese origin. And later generations have said that was outrageous, that never should have been done. And so now in many jurisdictions, we're sort of incarcerating millions of Americans in their home. It's like every generation we we have to relearn that the Constitution, while the Constitution is flexible enough to enable us to deal with emergencies, we should not be throwing out the Constitution or individual rights or economic prosperity in order to deal with emergencies.
And please tell some of my Facebook friends, this is not, when we hear these stay-at-home orders from our governor here, Governor Cuomo, whatever, this is not martial law. Please explain what martial law is.
No, it's not martial law. Martial law is military law, essentially, where the government can jail you and hold you indefinitely. Try you in military courts, abolish jury trial. We haven't, thank goodness, gone that far yet.
He's been a professional, rather a constitutional law professor and a professional for 25 years, senior fellow now in constitutional jurisprudence at the Independence Institute in Denver and a senior advisor to the Convention of States Project, Professor Rob Nadelson. Professor, thank you so much. It's been enthralling. It's been educational. We thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Welcoming back a friend of the program here. You hear him a lot. Republican State Senator George Logan from the Valley, 17th District. George, how are you, my friend?
Oh, doing well, Paul. How's everything?
We're trying to keep it together, George. A lot of people calling in, a surprising amount of people I see out on the roads. I know you wanted to highlight something, George, that was done very nice gesture by the Chinese-American community in your district. Tell us about that.
Sure. We have a pretty vibrant and active Chinese-American community in the district towns that I represent, the 17th district, or also throughout the state. And, they recognize that there's a need in the community like many of us have. We put a call out there for folks to donate food to local food pantries. I mean, as this continues on, more and more people are going to run out of money, and they need money to buy food. So food is becoming more and more of a scarcity as the days go on. They wanted to help out. They asked how they could, and I said, donating food. So over 1,000 pounds of food was donated earlier this week, and we had to pick a food pantry, so we picked the Salvation Army spot over in Ansonia, and they came down. They had minivan loads of food, and we dropped them off, and even as we were dropping them off, people were coming into the food pantry and taking their family packages. That the Salvation Army puts together for families in need.
That's, I got to tell you, George, that is another example of when times go bad and times get tough, even though we'll eventually come out of this, it's when everybody puts their differences aside, you realize what the important things are, and a lot of people step up to do this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, I certainly would encourage folks, if you, have extra, non-perishable food items, certainly the Salvation Army Food Pantry. But if you go out to my website, www.senatorgeorgelogan.com, we have listed other areas, perhaps near closer to where you live, to your home, where you could perhaps donate some food as well.
All right.
In addition to that, we've got the food drive, but we're also making a drive for medical PPE, protective equipment for folks. And tomorrow we're doing a big drop at Griffin Hospital. Collected over 4,500 face masks from folks throughout the community, throughout the state. And I'm very proud that the community is able to come together to help out our healthcare workers as well that are on the front line. And we're going to keep going. We're going to keep finding and identifying areas where the community can help. And as safely as we can do it, we're going to try to get that done and work our way through this.
Okay. So again, George mentioned that tomorrow folks can drop this off at Griffin Hospital, correct?
Griffin Hospital, yes. They're accepting donations at any time, but I've coordinated with the Chinese-American community a collection of these medical protective equipment items, like face masks, like gloves, and we're going to be dropping those off tomorrow at 11 o'clock. And we're going to do it outside. We're not going inside the hospital. We're going to do it right from outside the main lobby area. There's an awning there. We're going to make sure that we exhibit enough space between each other, and we're going to get that done and try to highlight how our hospitals are in need, our healthcare workers are in need of protective equipment, and obviously those in our community that are economically disadvantaged could use some food as well. So we're all coming together and doing what we can to help out in this time of need.
All right, George. And finally, Connecticut state government, obviously, you've shut down the Capitol. I know the building has been cleaned out. So still no real movement, nothing being done, correct, George, that people should know about of the Capitol. Everybody's in a holding pattern, correct?
We're definitely in a holding pattern. I mean, we pushed out the potential of going back into session into mid-April. But that's, you know, that's very dynamic, very fluid situation. We're looking at this day by day. You know, we're on the up end of the curve, right? The coronavirus positive tests are coming back, and they're increasing, and they're going to continue to increase before they come down. So we really need to see how this plays out in terms of the pandemic itself here in Connecticut. And we're going day by day. I just jumped off of a virtual town hall meeting with Governor Lamont.
Mm-hmm.
Folks that want to see it, it's on CTN TV. You know, he's trying to communicate as best he can. Lieutenant Governor Bicek was on there as well, as well as our congressional senators as well. All of us working together. Communication is key. And I'm glad to see that people are certainly doing their best to follow the lead from the governor's office. And that also means providing suggestions to the governor on how to make the situation better for individuals, for businesses that are trying to stay afloat. So we're all, you've heard the phrase many, many times. We are truly all in this together, working together and trying in a positive way to help ourselves through this crisis.
Yeah, George, one thing, I don't know whether anyone has said this, and somebody asked if anyone could check on this, and I don't know whether you can, George, or you have any contacts, but somebody called me the other day, George, and the guest, by the way, is Republican State Senator George Logan. You know, George, there's been this controversy about, does this anti-malaria drug have any hopes for maybe certain kinds of coronavirus patients? And somebody had asked me on the program, George, are Connecticut hospitals, doing anything with this? There are some hospitals that have this drug on hand. Some have ordered it. George, have you heard anything about that? Do you know whether our hospitals are looking into that or not?
Sure. So I'm on the Griffin Hospital Board of Directors, but I must say that I am a mechanical engineer, right?
Okay.
Not a medical expert or a doctor in any means.
Yeah.
So from my vantage point, hospitals aren't on their own, experimenting with different combinations of drugs to try to, alleviate in terms of treatment or to, act as a preventative method for it. We have the CDC and other researchers are doing that. However, when it comes to a treatment, certainly the hospitals are doing all they can to make sure they have the proper equipment in terms of ventilators, in terms of treatment options that are known and proven and previously accepted. We're not doing a lot of experimenting at a local hospital level, as far as I can tell.
All right, George Logan. George, thanks. Once again, folks, if you have any donated safety equipment tomorrow, as George said, Griffin Hospital in Derby. Republican State Senator George Logan, 17th District. George, thank you. Stay safe and keep away from people, and we'll talk
to
you down the road.
Keep
thanks.
Washing those hands.
That's
keep
right.
Washing those hands.
Wash those hands. George, stock up on that hand sanitizer, will you? Okay. George, thanks. We'll be in touch.
Where I can find it.
Thanks, George. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.